We turn to John chapter 2. I decided to talk about the wedding at Cana, partly because since we've been here, there have been two weddings, and one coming up, I guess, in about a year. We had a wedding back in our home church in Kentucky about 10 hours ago. It was a Saturday. So I thought the wedding of Cana would be an appropriate topic to talk about. So John chapter 2. In the third day, verse 1, in the third day there was a marriage in the Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus said unto him, "They have no wine." Jesus said unto her, "Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come." His mother said unto the servants, "Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it." And there were set there six water pots of stone, after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing two or three firkins apiece. And Jesus said unto them, "Fill the water pots with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said unto them, "Draw out now, and bear unto the governor of the feast," and they bear it. And when the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was, but the servants which drew the water knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom, and saith unto him, "Every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine. And when men are well drunk, then that which is worse, but thou hast kept the good wine until now." In the beginning of the miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee, and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him. Probably various ways you could preach this passage. One would be perhaps to think about it as being probably the first miracle that Jesus performed, and then get in a discussion of miracles in general and talk about what miracles were and how we know they're miracles rather than just physical manifestations. The second approach might be to use this as kind of a springboard to talk about marriage and point out that the first of Jesus' miracles was indeed at a wedding, and that probably implied that Jesus was condoning marriage and weddings, and that then you can get off in the discussion of marriage and talk about God's blessing on marriage and get into Ephesians chapter 5 and so forth. A third approach would be to do what I always like to do, and I was a little reluctant to do this at first, but my favorite form of preaching is to preach from the first person perspective. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could actually talk to someone who was there during a miracle? Wouldn't it be wonderful to, for instance, talk to one of the soldiers that marched around Jericho and be able to hear from his first-person account how the walls fell down? You could ask him, how did they actually fall down? Or wouldn't it be wonderful to be one of the crowd of thousands that Jesus broke the bread and multiplied the loaves? Wouldn't it be nice to be able to hear from a first-person account? So because of the make-believe technology of a time machine, we're able to have with us today a gentleman by the name of Jacob, who traveled 2,000 years into the future and was actually there during a feast, the feast that took place during the wedding of Cana. And if you can get by the cheesy Jewish accent, I think you can hopefully learn a great deal from Jacob's message to us. So he'll be with us in just a minute.
Hello and shalom. Welcome to my town of Cana. My name is Jacob. I have lived here forever, I think. This village is part of Galilee. Did you see the gardens and orchards and the best pomegranates in Palestine when you walked up the road? Nazareth is about 6 kilometers that way. We are only a couple of days from Bethany. Did you come from there? Cana, it's a small little village. I am a simple man in a simple little house in this small little village. But I have a big story to tell. Here, come in. Sit right down here. I bring you some food and I bring you some wine. I have got lots of wine. Got it from the in-laws last week. But that's the story. Let me tell you that. Their wedding was last week. But that's the story. They ran out of wine. Can you believe that? I could have sued them. But Jesus of Nazareth, He turned the water into wine. He turned the water into wine. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me start from the beginning. I decided to look into marriage customs in other countries. And I know the Jewish customs, but I was interested in other countries. So I met this man in the market. He was a sailor and merchant, a world traveler, I think. And he said that in Egypt, girls get married between the ages of 12 and 14. The men are usually older, 14 to 20. In Greece, girls get married as early as 12, but boys after the military service, usually 18 to 20, maybe as old as 30 years old. In Rome, the minimum age to get married for girls is about 12, and about half of the women are married by 15. Now, who out there is 14, 15, 12? I know I've got one daughter. We have to find you a husband, I guess. In Rome, a dowry is expected, a dowry, and this is money or goods that the bride gives to her husband. And this is why rich girls usually are married before poor girls. In Rome, if a girl is not married by age 19, she is considered an old maid. The fathers are totally in charge of arranging for weddings in Rome. Sometimes the father even marries off his daughter without consulting his wife. Can you imagine that? Hello, dear, I had a hard day at work, I built 3 chairs, I fought off 2 thieves, and I married off our daughter who will be leaving tomorrow. In the Jewish culture, marriage is usually arranged by the parents, although the mother can play a role. Remember in our Holy Scriptures that Rebecca expressed her concern to Isaac that Jacob would end up marrying one of the daughters of Heth. But fathers can act alone as well. In the Jewish culture, the consent of the bride may be asked, but it is not essential. Rebecca was asked if she was willing to go and to be Jacob's wife. And even romance may be involved, although not all the time. Remember all the years that Jacob was willing to serve to earn the privilege of marrying Rachel. In many cultures, there is a period of time before the wedding called a betrothal. In Mesopotamia, for instance, the betrothal is in effect with the transfer of gifts. The betrothal is sealed by the bride price, from the groom to the father of the bride. Now, this bride price in Mesopotamia is about 10 months' wages, in Babylonia actually, 10 months' wages. Why don't we have that custom here? Sounds pretty good to me. In early Greece, the betrothal occurred before the wedding, where the father of the bride promised his daughter to the groom before witnesses. Now, in Rome, marriages were usually, but not always, preceded with the betrothal. This could involve children as young as 7 years old. Any girls out there 7 years old? You want to be betrothed? The groom-to-be would place an iron ring on the fourth finger of the future bride and kiss her. Now, in Rome, the dowry was an important factor, with the size of it fixed with hard bargaining between the families. You can imagine that. In Israel, betrothal creates a legally binding relationship. Remember in our Holy Scriptures, even Jacob called Rachel his wife during this time before marriage. Betrothal usually preceded marriage by up to a year. The bridegroom personally hands the bride money or a letter in which he states his intentions.
The bride price or dowry represents a compensation, not a purchase. In other words, the groom is not purchasing the bride, but rather compensating the family for the loss of a daughter. Remember in our scriptures that Shechem was willing to pay any bride price for Dinah. God's law says that you have to pay the bride's price if you seduce an unbetrothed virgin. And sometimes the bride's price can be an act of valor or service rather than silver or gold. The men of Israel said that the king would reward whoever killed Goliath with his daughter as a bride. Remember that? Betrothal has very serious implications in our culture insofar as the law is concerned. The betrothed bride is legally considered a wife as far as inheritance and adultery is concerned. You need a divorce to break a formal betrothal. Remember years ago, my friend Joseph discovered that Mary was pregnant with Jesus. He could have publicly denounced her as an adulteress, but he didn't. Some cultures have ceremonies, others do not. In Rome, there's no legal ceremonies. In Egypt, no religious ceremonies. In Egypt, the father of the bride conducts the bride with rich gifts to the groom's house where a great feast is held. And in Greece, prior to the wedding, the bride offers up her toys, dedicates a lock of her hair, and purifies herself with a nuptial bath. In the Jewish cultures, marriages are usually celebrated with festivals in token of joy and friendly respect and for the confirming of love. The pious often fasted before weddings, confessing their sins. The bridal pair on the wedding day symbolized the union between God and Israel. The groom is attired in a wreath or matrimonial crown. The bride is festively dressed, adorned with jewels and veils. The wedding feast can last a day, a week, or even 2 weeks. Guests will be sitting around tables, on couches or chairs, with cushions or covered with trapped tapestry. Now, the wedding usually takes place on Wednesdays if a virgin, Thursdays if a widow. But let me tell you about Rebecca and Saul's wedding last week here in Cana. First, we all met in Rebecca's home here in Cana. Oh, those people. So many people. You should have seen it. It was bursting at the seams, I think. Many of the men and women made speeches. They expressed their hopes and dreams for the couple. Rebecca was led from the house to the house of the groom. Right along that path, right there, the winding path. Winding down the hill. Can you see it? It's right back there. There are merry sounds of music and song, instruments and singing. It was a festive procession. They marched in the morning while it was still dark. Many carried torches and lamps on poles. It was spectacular. During this march, wine and oil was given to the people, and nuts to the children. Rebecca was covered with a veil, as is our custom, and she was surrounded by her companions. In many marriages, the groom also has his friends leading the procession. But this is not our custom here in Cana of Galilee. Everyone rose to salute the procession, and in fact, many joined it. There were a lot more at the end of the march than at the beginning. People that greeted us from the side of the road called out praises to the couple. One would say, "Who can find such a virtuous woman?" Another would say, "Her price is far above rubies." And someone else would say, "She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life." It was such an encouragement.
The procession led to the home of the groom, right there over that hill. We had a small religious ceremony. When we got there, it said something like, "We take her according to the law of Moses and Israel." The bride and the bridegroom were covered with garlands, and of course, we signed the formal legal document where it said that the bridegroom would work for Rebecca and would honor and keep and care for Rebecca, as is the manner of the men of Israel, and that he promised to give her a certain amount of money. I forget how much it was. Then we washed our hands with water from the purification pots over there. More about these pots in a few minutes. We then filled our cups with wine and toasted to the happiness and fruitfulness of the new couple. Then we feasted and feasted. I can't remember if it was one day or two, but we ate too much, I must admit. The bride and groom were then led to the bridal chamber and the bed, and then, well, you know what comes next. But let me tell you what happened during the feast. Jesus of Nazareth and his mother Mary were important guests at this feast. We have known this family for years. The feast had gone on for hours. There was laughing and singing, and their food was outstanding. The lamb and spices and the wine. Well, at least there was wine. After a while, they ran out of wine. Can you imagine that? They ran out of wine. Perhaps they hadn't planned for all those people. And there were 5 extra disciples of Jesus. Maybe they weren't expected. What was the significance of running out of wine? What did it mean? It was the most embarrassing social mistake of the First Order. It implies that either the family was poor, or they had made just minimal provision, hoping to come out for the best, hoping that their wine would last. This could have even resulted in a lawsuit by the bride's parents against the family of the groom. It was a big deal. So after they ran out of wine, Mary, the mother of Jesus, asked him for help. I was the master of ceremonies. I was there. Mary simply walked up to Jesus and she said, "They have no wine." Now, I really don't know what Mary expected Jesus to do in this situation. He had not done any miracles before. Although Mary did tell me about his unusual birth. And she did tell me about the old man in the temple whose sight was restored when he saw the baby Jesus. And she did tell me about the time when Jesus was 12 and his parents found him in the temple. He said that he must be doing his father's business or something like that. Jesus had a very special relationship to God. Maybe Mary was expecting a miracle. On the other hand, perhaps Mary told Jesus that they ran out of wine so that he could make some kind of decent excuse to the company to save the bridegroom's reputation. I don't know. Maybe Mary knew that Jesus would do the miracle. Maybe she even thinks that Jesus is our Messiah. So Jesus' response to Mary was very interesting. Jesus said to Mary, "Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come." Can you imagine that? First of all, he called her woman and not mother. This was a polite kind of expression, but rather strange. It was unusual that Jesus did not call her mother. Maybe this kind of way of talking to his mother indicated perhaps a new kind of relationship. After all, if Jesus really is the Messiah, and he is about to embark on a ministry for God, perhaps he was signaling a new kind of relationship with his mother. I don't know. Perhaps it was a rebuke. Although calling her woman wasn't necessarily an insult, Jesus was simply saying, "Why do you involve me? It's not time yet." Not time for what? What is Jesus about to do? Or to start to do? So I've been thinking about this and wondering, maybe he is our Messiah. So after Jesus said, "My hour is not yet come," Mary told me to do whatever Jesus tells me to do, since I'm the governor of the feast. I guess that meant that she trusted him to do something in this situation, but I, for one, was not exactly sure what he was going to tell me to do. He told me to have the 6 water jars filled with water. Now, these water jars are used for ceremonial cleansing. They are used to wash our hands before and after meals, and to wash the eating vessels. In fact, there is an old Jewish saying that goes something like this: "He who uses much water in the washing will gain much wealth in this world." Now, these water jars, they hold about 20 or 30 gallons of water. They are about this big, but this big. I know they're this big because I tried to move them once and it landed on my toe. They're heavy stone jars. These water jars are usually kept outside. And actually, at the time, I, being the master of ceremonies, did not know that I was drinking from these ceremonial jars because, well, if I knew this, it would have been unthinkable. Jesus told the servants to fill the water pots with water. And they filled them to the brim, all the way to the top. And after they filled the pots with water, he then told them to draw from the pots and bring a sample to me, the governor of the feast. This word "governor of the feast" means literally ruler of a room with 3 couches. Now, I don't know why they call me ruler of the room with 3 couches, but I'm just the head of the ceremony, I guess. Anyway, they brought me their wine, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was outstanding wine. I think that I said something like, "Usually you serve the best wine first, and then when the people have drunk a little, you serve the lower quality wine, but you have saved the best wine till last." I mean, this was great wine. Now, some people wonder about our custom of drinking wine. They wonder whether the scriptures say anything about drinking wine, or in fact, whether Jesus was for or against drinking wine. But let me set the record straight. This was wine. I don't believe that the Holy Scriptures say anything about not drinking any wine at all. It does say that drunkenness is evil and that it should be avoided. But let me tell you something about our wine. Normally, we dilute our wine, 1 part of wine to 20 parts of water, or as strong as 1 part of wine to 1 part of water. It's diluted wine. It's not straight wine. I've been thinking about this miracle of Jesus and wondering about the circumstances surrounding it. Why did Jesus do this miracle this way? And how did these circumstances confirm the fact that it was, in fact, a miracle and not a fake? First of all, Jesus used those ceremonial water pots. I would not have chosen those pots at all. This would have been unthinkable. I would have chosen something else. But you know, there would be no residue of grapes in those pots. No residue at all. No way that water could be made to taste like wine because of the residue of grapes. That's why Jesus used the water pots rather than the empty wine vessels. Secondly, the servants, they filled the water pot all the way to the brim, all the way to the top. There would be no room left for anything else to be added. No one could accuse us of topping off the top pots with wine to make it look like a miracle. They filled it all the way to the top. And thirdly, the water was turned into wine suddenly, without ceremony, just like that. God sometimes does things without pomp and circumstance. Remember how Naaman was healed of his leprosy by dipping himself in the river? He wanted God to make a big deal about healing him. But God just healed him. What was the significance of this miracle? What does it mean? I don't know. I have been thinking about this a lot, though. Some even question whether the miracle actually happened. They even accused me of joking when I said that this was the best wine of all. They thought that I was playing along with some big practical joke. Mary says the wine went out. Jesus says fill the pots with water. I say this is the best wine of all, like it was some big joke. But it was no joke. Believe me, I was there. The water turned into wine. The best wine of all. There may be a second significance to this miracle. Try to compare this miracle to the miracle of Moses when he turned the water into blood in Egypt. That was a sign of judgment upon Pharaoh. This is a sign of blessing and joy to the family who ran out of wine. Also, the beginning of Moses' miracles was when he turned the water into blood. Maybe this would be the beginning of Jesus' miracles as well. There may be yet another significance of this miracle. Maybe this would be the first of many miracles of Jesus, and it has to do with a marriage and a wedding. Maybe Jesus was showing us the honor that he places on marriage. He made it to be the setting of his very first miracle.